This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We recently read the moving story of Dawson Riverman, who was born without fingers on his left hand. Here is a bit from the article in the New York Times written by Jacqueline Mraz. He struggled to perform even the simplest tasks, like tying a shoe or holding a ball. God made you special in this way, his parents told him. But by age 5, Dawson was demanding tearfully to know why. Then at 13, an online volunteer organization called Enable matched Dawson to a complete stranger who made him a low-cost prosthetic hand with movable fingers using a 3D printer. Now Dawson's hand looks more like a transformer. Jonathan Schull is research scientist in magic at RIT and founder of Enable. John Schull, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
Any idea of how many kids are in need of prosthetic hands?
You know, you'd think that was a simple question. There are somewhere between 1 in 2,000 and 1 in 10,000 children are born with an upper limb abnormality of some kind. Some fraction of those are candidates for the particular devices that we have, and more are going to be candidates for the kinds of devices we're developing.
Mm-hmm.
And worldwide, of course, it's not just a matter of birth abnormalities. Amputations, either accidental or, frankly, politically inspired, are a serious problem. So we have our work cut out for us.
Well, what are some of the particular challenges of getting prosthetic hands to kids?
You know, the traditional challenge has been that they are quite expensive. They have little appeal for kids because they're heavy, because they look like poor imitations of the real thing. And they are delicate and require often prosthetic fitting.
Mm-hmm.
But we've changed that. It turns out that for some fraction of kids who need them, prosthetics are sort of like shoes. If you can offer them in a variety of sizes and widths and styles, you can fit them fairly routinely to some class of patients who don't have wounds and who are in an environment in which we can provide these very inexpensive, light, colorful, kid-friendly, superhero, 3D-printed plastic hands.
That's what's so amazing. So you started Enable. This is an online volunteer organization. Now, explain what that means. People actually volunteer to print out prosthetic hands and fingers for kids?
No kidding. That's the whole story.
Wow. Where do they get the designs or the material?
Well, some of our volunteers develop designs. The materials themselves come standard with the printers, and our volunteers typically just donate the materials. It's about $10 worth of 3D printing plastic and perhaps $10 or $15 worth of auxiliary parts like Velcro to attach them to the hands and so on. That expense currently is borne by the volunteers themselves.
Wow.
And we have a very active and very effective design community working on the designs, working on software for customizing the designs for a particular patient, working on websites and fundraising techniques and all sorts of things. There's a lot of things for volunteers to do.
How do they fit them to the kids?
We have an intake process where we get measurements of the hand and the residual hand. And we use that with some software we've created called Handomatic Software. It runs in a web browser. You can check it out at our website, enablingthefuture.org, under resources. And with that software, you can simply enter a few key measurements, pick your style, and within minutes, custom proportioned printable files are delivered to your mailbox, suitable for printing if you have a printer, and suitable for sending to one of our volunteers if you don't have a printer.
How long does it take to actually make them and print them out?
The physical printing process is, you know, on the order of 18 to 20 hours. Then there's 3 or 4 hours of assembly. And there's also a fair number of hours that goes into the process of matching someone who needs a hand with someone who's willing to print it. That work is all being done by volunteers currently, but in truth, we've, I think, gotten to the point where there are some things volunteers can't or won't or shouldn't do. So we've created an Enable Community Foundation whose job it is to support the community and help it self-organize.
Jonathan Scull is my guest. He's research scientist in magic at RIT and founder of Enable, a global network of volunteers who use 3D printers to make prosthetic hands for children. I did watch a video of someone named Jeremy Simon. He's from 3D Universe assembling a prosthetic hand. It's a very DIY, non-proprietary kind of community, it seems. The
Absolutely.
Designs are all open source. So are there any industries trying to crowd in on this or professionalize it or make money from it?
Well, I wouldn't describe it as crowding in. In fact, we're inviting industry to learn from what we're doing. And on the one hand, I think the industry is watching us very carefully, and some members of the industry are beginning to talk to us, the industry being the prosthetics community, about using or adapting our designs in order to make them more readily available in standardized formats to medical professionals so that they're more likely to get covered by health insurance. Our mission is just to make sure that inexpensive prosthetics are available to anyone anywhere, and we're going to do that both by giving them away for free, which has a magical tendency to drive down costs, and by trying to help mainstream these technologies so that they become part of standard practice when they're appropriate.
So how do they work? Do they open and close? Do the fingers curl and flex?
That's exactly right. For the model, which is our most common solution, for children who have hands but not fingers, when they bend their wrist, they make a fist. There are strings that go from the forearm to the palm. When you bend your wrist, those strings are tightened. Those strings then cause the fingers to flex closed. So it's very simple. It's body powered. And that in itself is also adaptive and appealing to children. It actually gives them exercise. It gives them control. And it also probably helps develop muscles.
Well, the other thing that's so amazing about them, you referred to this earlier, they're not meant to look like flesh-colored or real.
That's right.
How do they look?
Well, you know, we had a kid in Hawaii last summer who, you'll probably find the picture, he's got one of the great smiles of the 21st century. And he said, "I got a new Iron Man hand." And indeed, it was orange and yellow and Iron Man colors. That took off like wildfire. Within weeks, our volunteers were producing Iron Man hands and Spider-Man hands and Hulk hands and all sorts of variations. And the kids love them because they're kids. But also, frankly, the superhero motif is just the right metaphor, right? Every superhero has some kind of a flaw. Superman has a kryptonite problem, et cetera. And yet they have superpowers that give them amazing abilities. And these devices are like that. So the kids like them because they're cool. They like them because they're kid-friendly. And they like them because they play into the psychological benefits of these devices, which are at least as important as the mechanical benefits.
I'm looking at some of the models, the cyborg beast. It looks like something
That's
from
right.
Transformer, the raptor hand. I mean, that must mean, or I read in the Times, that in some cases, kids who once were teased for their disability now are the envy of their classmates who want one just like it. That has to feel pretty good to you, John Shull.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. And, you know, it's interesting. We have one recipient. His name is Nathaniel. He's a very articulate little guy, and he was anticipating this device. It was 6 weeks before Christmas, and he said, I'm getting my new hand in about 6 weeks. And he says, you know, I have bad dreams, and there are these monsters who are coming after me. And now I tell them, you can't scare me. I've got two hands. And this is before he got the device. When the kids get the devices, they say, and their parents say, he's a different kid now. His self-confidence has gone through the roof. He's the coolest kid in the class. The news, New York Times piece that you read may give the false impression that kids missing fingers or hands are severely limited. In truth, if they're born with this, they become very competent in general. And it's actually the social consequences which are the most burdensome. And we had a mother say, you know, I was sort of skeptical because my kid can do anything he needs to do, even though he's missing a hand. But we were in the park the other day, and not for the first time, another kid came up and asked my child, why is your hand so funny? And instead of being embarrassed this time, my child said, well, I have a special hand, and come on, I'll show you in the car. I've got a special robot hand. And the kids are playing together, and by the time they were done, this other kid says, boy, are you lucky. So it really changes the whole nature of the interaction, the self-image, and the other image. It's a very big deal for these kids.
Well, now I understand your title at RIT, Research Scientist in Magic, all the better. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
John Schull is also founder of Enable. Now, you can see pictures of kids with their 3D printed hands, as well as videos of the raptor hand and the cyborg beast, all at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Once every decade, the U.S. government conducts a census to count its citizen. But what about when it comes to counting wild animals in the forest? The math is a little bit more complicated. Coming up, NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown explains how animal populations are calculated. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We often hear biologists or conservationists throw around population estimates for wild animals. Maybe we can imagine counting bison on the Great Plains, but how about estimating the number of fish in the sea or newts in the forest? NHPR's environment reporter Sam Evans-Brown brings us this story on how you go about counting animals when you can't just go and knock at their door with a clipboard in hand.
Karen Bordeaux, our small game project leader, is ill tonight. So I said I'd fill in.
Fish and Game just finished up a series of presentations all around the state where they're shopping around their wildlife management plan.
Small game populations are...
Basically, it's a chance for hunters to come and see what the biologists are saying about how the populations of deer, turkey, moose, and bear are doing and how many of each species they'll be allowed to shoot. The material is dense. Here's a little sample from Fish and Game's deer biologist, Dan Bergeron.
For deer, this is the two-year running average of the adult buck kill. That's what we use as an index to the trend in the population.
Brr. I mean, what did that even mean? The hunters in the crowd, like Brandon O'Brien, don't even get it.
It appears that most of their numbers come from the deer kills, is what it appears, and that's not accurate at all. How are they saying that's accurate? So they're saying that there's more deer in section L and M based off of deer getting killed is the most there, but in all reality, that's the most people that hunt those areas.
So what is this inscrutable science? How do biologists know how many deer there are in the woods?
So if you had to do, like, you've got the jar of jelly beans, and you're guessing how many jelly beans are in there. If you had to do that for the deer population, and you only had your model, how confident would you be that you'd be, you know, that you'd get the jar of jelly beans?
Well, I'd be extremely confident because there's no way to count the jar of jelly beans, I guess would be my answer.
There's no way to count the jelly beans. This is the central problem. It's like, imagine trying to count a couple of hundred identically sized bouncy balls, and you can only reach inside with one hand, no peeking. Of course, some animals are easier to count than others. For instance, loons.
And that's probably one of the few instances where you can actually go out, count the number of nesting loons on a particular lake, and have a fairly accurate idea of how that population is doing.
This is an expert in the science of population estimates.
Okay. I'm John Litvitus. I'm professor of wildlife ecology at the University of New Hampshire.
For many species of wildlife, there are either too many of them or they're too hard to find to do an actual census. So imagine you're trying to estimate salamanders.
You would set up pitfall traps, which are essentially holes dug in the ground with a 3 or 4 gallon container inserted in that hole, and a drift fence, which sort of guides the salamander to that cup. They plop in, and you get a count. You also can apply then a mark to the individual animals that you've captured, release them back into the wild, and you repeat this for 3 to 4 days. You get a number of animals that you've marked, recaptured, and unmarked individuals.
Before you dwell too long on the image of a 4-gallon bucket full of live salamanders, let's just hit that point one more time. By releasing and recapturing animals, you get a sense of how many are out there that you didn't see, which, of course, you can use to estimate how many you have total.
Basically, the tools are math.
The way you get the numbers to do that math depends on the animal you're after. Salamanders are easy enough to funnel into a bucket, but for other animals, you can just find little traces of DNA they've left behind.
We've done this a lot with New England cottontail. It's a very efficient technique for that animal because the average rabbit, believe it or not, defecates 600 pellets a day. And they're not very picky about where they leave their samples.
Of course, some animals are a little more discreet. For example, bobcats, like many cats, often bury their leavings.
As a result, the ingenuity of some biologists has been to train dogs to locate scats. And there now are commercial vendors out there that have trained dogs that will come to your study site and help you locate a sufficient sample of scats of the animal that you're interested in.
Sniffing rental dogs, customizable by species. You can get an estimate of animals per square mile of habitat, multiply by the habitat available statewide, and boom, population estimate. All of this brings us back to the question that got us started going down this road. How can Fish and Game be responsibly making decisions on how many deer hunters can shoot when their primary data point is the number of deer that hunters have shot? Remember, some of the hunters think this is preposterous.
So they're saying that there's more deer in section L and M based off of deer getting killed is the most there, but in all reality, that's the most people that hunt those areas. It's the most developed area. A lot of people are going to hunt those areas. The further you go north, less people are traveling north to go hunting. There's less people that live there.
But this is where the biology comes in. Fish and Game isn't actually trying to pick a number of deer they want the state to have. They're just trying to manage the trajectory of the population. Do people want there to be more deer in New Hampshire or fewer?
No one really manages based on estimated numbers because we know there's error in that. So to try and measure or to try and manage for an estimated number is it's really something that's dangerous to do because you know there's a lot of variation in that number. So
here it is, your senior seminar in understanding why the number of bucks shot by hunters is a good indicator of deer population trends.
The yearling male deer is physiologically the most sensitive animal in the population. They're the lowest rung on the social structure. So they are occupying or relegated to occupying perhaps the poorest habitat in the deer neighborhood. Now, if you're sticking with me, that results in certain body parts growing at a rate that reveals the quality of the habitat that they occupy.
This could get really...
weedy. This could get weedy. Okay. The antler diameter is a consequence of quality of food. If a yearling deer is in fairly poor habitat, its antlers will essentially be 3 or 4 inch nubs.
So what does this tell us? If there are too many deer for the habitat available, those yearlings will be scrawny, hungry, and have runty little antlers.
Is the population at carrying capacity, meaning that it's being nutrient limited, or well below carrying capacity, being nutrient rich? So if you follow that example, you're pretty much able to be a deer biologist today. So, the other statistics that are used are much more simple. Body weight, antler beam diameter, and there's one last statistic is hunter success. Number of bucks harvested per square mile. And it turns out all those parameters are highly correlated, that if you measure one, you're pretty much measuring the others.
So there you have it. Why go through all the trouble of, say, scouring the forest for deer poop or hiring a helicopter with a thermal camera to fly over hundreds of square miles counting deer when science has already demonstrated that if hunter numbers remain relatively constant, their success is a good measure of whether the population is rising or falling. It's a handy shortcut. When you break it down the way we have in this conversation, I have to say it's an incredible testament to the value of the training of biologists out there.
Hooray!
For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
Calculating deer populations may be stressful, but spending time in the woods is one way that people quiet their racing minds. When we come back, Word of Mouth investigates the medical benefits of mindfulness and meditation. Stick around for that after a short break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For centuries, various forms of meditation have been used to quiet the mind and focus attention. Using the technology of today, researchers can see what happens to the brains and bodies of people who meditate regularly. The resulting data shows that meditation positively affects metabolism, brain chemistry, immunity, and responses to stress. Some evidence links mindfulness meditation practices to changes on the cellular level, which could slow the aging process or be used in the treatment of cancer. Dr. Judson Brewer is director of research at the Center for Mindfulness at UMass Medical School. He's the featured speaker at Concord Hospital's Payson Center for Cancer Care's Anti-Cancer Lifestyle Program. It's going to be on Tuesday, April 14th. And Dr. Judson Brewer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
No, thanks for having me.
Well, how do you describe mindfulness, first off?
Mindfulness, you know, it's interesting. It has a lot of different definitions out there right now, but I like the simple one where it's you're just simply paying attention to what's going on right now, but really bringing a non-judgmental attitude to it. So you're not judging as you go in. You're keeping a very open mind.
So what do you study at the Center for Mindfulness?
We study mindfulness.
Everybody's walking around there being very present tense.
Well, you know, it's funny. There's a joke here. We run a stress reduction clinic because it's mindfulness-based stress reduction. But there's this joke around that it's stressful to take the stress reduction program. And it's interesting because, you know, you have to be able to look at how you're creating your own stress to be able to let go of it. And so in that sense, you kind of have to clean out the closet a little bit, and that can be a little stressful, at least at the beginning in itself.
Can this be done in one's daily life or only through the state of meditation?
Well, I think it has to be done in one's daily life. And even in some of the work that we've done with smokers, for example, we focus on the training in the daily life and use the meditation as foundational support for that.
Well, okay, so now we can use fMRI, EEG, different ways to measure what's happening in the body and the brain while meditating. So what is going on?
What is going on in the brain?
Yes. Okay. I mean, a lot, obviously, but anything that you can help identify for us for the purpose of this stress reduction, habit reduction.
Sure. Well, the first thing I'll say is that these studies are very early on. But one thing that we've noticed that is interesting when you look at both novice and experienced meditators and you have them meditate as compared to not doing anything in particular, their entire brain quiets down. And one way to think about that is, you know, it's as if you've been driving your car with one foot on the accelerator and one on the brake. And if you suddenly pull your foot off the brake, your car goes faster and it drives more efficiently, even though you haven't been adding more energy to the system.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, the whole brain says, oh, you know, thank goodness you're getting out of your own way so I can work more efficiently. And I think one of the more consistent findings is that there's this network of brain regions called the default mode network that gets activated when we're doing something self-referential. So when we're worrying about something that's coming up or regretting something that happened in the past, those are like putting the foot on the brake while we're trying to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And that piece is optional. You know, we don't have to worry. It's not going to help us get whatever, you know, needs to happen later done better. And it's not going to fix the past. It might actually make things worse when we get into ruminative thought patterns.
So that worry, though, is that something that's going on in the mind or the brain?
That is a trick question.
Well, the idea is that you must be able to make them stop, but we know from neuroscience now that the brain wears grooves in it, you know, where certain pathways, like that worry response, is a well-trod path, and it goes right to that.
It is. So if you think of the worry response as a fire that's burning, for example, so let's say that every time you worry, that's that big flame that's burning, and you need sustenance for that fire. So every time we have a thought, that adds fuel to that fire of worry. So if we get in a ruminative thought pattern, you know, we're just adding fuel to the fire and it keeps burning. And I think that's what you're talking about in terms of grooving those pathways.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the interesting thing about mindfulness is it's not that it comes in and, you know, suddenly puts the fire out, because these things can grow to be, you know, wildfires or forest fires. But what it does is help us dig a fire line around the fire so that we stop adding fuel to it. And when you stop adding fuel, the fire eventually burns down on its own. So what we're doing is changing our relationship to those thought patterns so that they naturally lose their grip over us or lose control and we stop getting sucked into them or mm-hmm. caught up in them.
Okay, so the research, you know, I have to admit, very superficial, that I was doing on how this has been tested, and as you said, it's all preliminary, shows that meditation, mindfulness meditation, can actually change the sympathetic nervous system on a cellular level, shortening telomeres, which are connected with cancer. Can you tell us a little bit about that relationship between mindfulness meditation and treatment or prevention even of cancer?
Sure. And I'm not an expert here, so I would defer to the cancer experts. But what I can say is that there's been a lot of work that's been done both on the field of stress and cancer and stress and chronic disease in general. There's a good mind-body relationship that's been established, or I should say there's always been a mind-body relationship, but there's been a good body of evidence suggesting that the mind can actually affect the body, that the two are not separate. And so when we're stressed out, it affects a whole host of systems, including the immune system, for example. So we get sick when we get stressed out. Well, that's a mind-body connection. And the same thing is true in general, you know, for cancer. And so we need a strong immune system to help with cancer. We need a strong, you know, a functioning body to work in a number of ways with our cellular repair mechanisms, et cetera. And so you're using telomeres, for example. It's been shown, and this has been work that's been done by Alyssa Eppel at UCSF and others around the country. You know, telomeres are these caps at the end of our chromosomes, and it's kind of like one of the analogies that's been used is your genes. You know, if the bottom of your genes start to get frayed, then your genes start to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if your genes are intact at the bottom, then they're going to last longer. And the same thing is true for chromosomes. If that cap, that telomere cap, is long, it helps keep the chromosomes intact so they can replicate well.
Mm-hmm.
And mindfulness has been associated, and meditation has been associated, with reduced shortening of the telomeres so that they're, you know, that the fraying doesn't happen as quickly or as much.
We're talking to Dr. Judson Brewery, he's director of research at the Center for Mindfulness at UMass Medical School, and he's going to be featured speaker. His talk, Please Pay Attention Now, will be featured at the Payson Center for Cancer Care's Anti-Cancer Lifestyle Program in Concord. Well, I've read about how the brains of like Buddhist monks or somebody who's been a practice meditator for a long time and may meditate for hours a day can be changed. But you mentioned something earlier about even novice meditators. So how do we begin?
How do we begin? Just by paying attention. You know, we all have this capacity, just like anybody listening to the show. It doesn't take any extra effort for them to listen to the sound of our voices. And so that's a natural inherent capacity. The critical piece to start with is to notice when we're caught up in that, when we're getting in our own way. So when we're caught up in a thought, or when we're preoccupied, or when we're daydreaming, just noticing the difference between being lost in that and then just being fully present. So that in itself almost creates a Skinner box. You know, B.F. Skinner was this behaviorist where he would shock animals in, you know, a black chamber versus a white chamber, or shock them in the white chamber versus a black chamber. And through that, the animals would learn to prefer the one where they didn't get shocked. And in the same way, we can notice that when we're caught up in stuff, it's like we're shocking ourselves. It's much more painful than when we're just fully present. Now, there are formal practices that folks can do. It's pretty straightforward to drop into the physical sensation of the breath, you know, just for a few moments, and be curious. What does it feel like physically in my belly or at the tip of my nose or in my chest, wherever I feel it most strongly? Or even just dropping into the physical sensations of the hands or the feet. You know, it can be very grounding, literally, to just stop and drop into the body and notice what the body feels like. Not trying to change anything, not having an agenda besides just making sure that I'm here now. And there's this idea of, you know, short moments many times. If we can do this for 5 or 10 seconds and we can do it well, then we start to groove the 5 seconds at a time where when we notice that we're caught up in something, we can actually let go and then let go. You know, it's the rinse and repeat.
It's just such a fight, though, it seems to me, Judson Brewer. I mean, we do live in this world that rewards activity, rewards multitasking, and the most active people or the most active Twitter feeds, let's put it that way. So how to slow down, how to pay attention to just one thing? Does it take a lot of practice?
Well, I would say it's really looking at what the reward actually is. You know, is excitement actually a reward that we want as compared to peace or calm or joy? And I would say even just paying attention to when we're multitasking versus when we're just doing one thing at a time, we start to note, at least for myself, I can say the multitasking is exasperating. And I at the end, I feel exhausted and frustrated, and I don't feel like I've attended to any one thing in particular. So I have to go back and, you know, see what I missed. Whereas doing things in serial as compared to in parallel, it really feels pretty calm and, you know, and focused and joyful. So there's even the reward in not multitasking is there. It's just a matter of looking for it.
Dr. Judson Brewer, Director of Research at the Center for Mindfulness at UMass Medical School. He also has affiliations at Yale and at MIT. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Judson Brewer's talk, Please Pay Attention Now, will be at Concord Hospital's Payson Center for Cancer Care's Anti-Cancer Lifestyle Program. That's on Tuesday, April 14th. More information and a link to watch his TED Talk on how to get out of your own way, that's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Living in the moment does clearly have some benefits, but remembering the past is also important. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and when we come back, we're going to hear about the relatively recent origins of the word genocide and how it's changed the way that we think about international atrocities. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day. At a mass yesterday in Rome, Pope Francis revived a century-old debate when he described the slaughter of 1.5 million Armenians by the Ottoman Turks 100 years ago as the first genocide of the 20th century. The Turkish government, which has consistently denied the numbers and the nature of the massacre, called the Pope's claims unfounded and recalled its ambassador to the Vatican. It's not the first time a government has denied past atrocities. And while human history has been stained by many examples of barbarity, the term genocide is a relatively recent invention, created by a Polish lawyer of Jewish descent named Raphael Lemkin.
Most people don't believe that other people are capable of these kinds of crimes, even today. But Lemkin knew.
In Rwanda, up to 200,000 people have died in a month.
About 1.3 million Syrians have fled their country's bloody two-year conflict.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has been accused of masterminding a campaign of genocide in Darfur.
The Genocide Convention marked the first time that the deliberate killing of a large group of people, especially those of a particular ethnic group or nation, could be prosecuted by international law. And yet the world that vowed never again after World War II has seen more unspeakable atrocities at Srebrenica, in Rwanda, in Syria, and elsewhere. The horrors committed in these places are remembered in Watchers of the Sky, a documentary film which debuted at Sundance last year and is now available on demand. I spoke with director and producer Edith Belsberg about the term genocide when the film was released last year. So a little background first on Raphael Lemkin and what led him to a lifetime of, let's say, dogged commitment to addressing genocide.
Well, you know, Lemkin, this is something that consumed him since his childhood. You know, he was, unlike most kids, I think from a very early age, he was taken with moral tales that his mother was reading him, with Aesop's Fables and La Fontaine, and this stayed with him for the rest of his life, really. And when he read about the killings and massacres of the Armenians, he really said to himself, how is this happening today? And that led him on a lifelong pursuit. And he asked himself the question at a very young age, why is the killing of a million a lesser crime than the killing of an individual?
It is such a story. This man forced from his own country when Hitler invades Poland.
Yes.
And by the way, among Hitler's generals, apparently, they said, you know, why do you think you can get away with this? And Hitler says, what did he say? Something like, you know, they did it in Armenia.
He said, well, who today remembers what happened to the Armenians?
Yeah.
Lemkin and Hitler took a very different lesson from the Armenian genocide. Mm-hmm. And the lesson Lemkin took was, how do I prevent this from happening to anybody ever again? And once it happened to him and his people, he not only wanted to protect himself and his family and his people, but he wanted to find a way to stop this from ever happening to anyone again and to protect humanity from this crime.
Well, that's what one of the things that we learn in the book from you have profiles of, you know, four other unbelievably courageous people fighting genocide in their own way, including Samantha Power. Mm-hmm. She wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning book, A Problem from Hell, about mm-hmm. genocide. Now she is U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Now, she tells us that there was not an existing crime to charge Hitler with for killing the Jews. Really? Why couldn't he be charged?
Well, under the Nuremberg laws, he had to cross an international border. So as she says in the film, if Hitler would have only killed all the Jews of Germany, he technically would not have been convicted, or his generals would have been convicted of a crime against humanity in the books at that time. Mm. But it's because they crossed the borders, because they went into Poland and they went into other countries, that they then could be convicted. So that was what Lemkin took issue with. He said, my God, it shouldn't be legal to kill the people who, you know, in your own country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he worked against. It should be equally illegal for a leader to kill tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, you know, millions of his or own people. And Lemkin sought to make that a crime. He wanted to ensure that leaders could not kill their people with impunity, which is still something that we're struggling with today.
Right. And this is something we see borne out in the film. But there is this terrific sequence where we see Lemkin, his notes and his struggles to come up with a name for this long, terrible history of barbarism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why was the word so important? What would that do?
Well, he really hoped that the word would bind humanity. He really believed that he could find that one word, if he could find the right word, that would be enough. He felt that if the word encompassed the horrors, that people would come together to stop it from happening again.
Mm-hmm.
And he really believed that words held that weight and held that power. sadly, that was not the case. He coined the term genocide. It was used in Nuremberg, and then it was incorporated in the dictionary, and it was something he was, of course, to be very proud of, but he saw that it wasn't enough. And when once he saw that it wasn't enough, that's when he turned his attention to creating the Genocide Convention and pushing that through the United Nations. And he, again, thought that that would be enough to stop these crimes from happening again.
We're going to hear a little bit of a clip of Ben Ferenc at Nuremberg. But first, a little context. There's an exchange with a Nazi commander of the Einsatzgruppen. These are the death squads. Now, he tells the court that 90,000 people were killed under his command between June of 1941 and 1942. And then we'll hear from Ben Ferenc.
Sind von den Einsatzkommandos etwa 90,000 als liquidiert gemeldet worden.
The killing of defenseless civilians during a war may be a war crime, but the same killings are part of another crime, a graver one, if you will, genocide.
Now, Ben Ferenc met Lemkin at Nuremberg. What were his impressions of this guy?
You know, Lemkin had one goal. You know, he had one goal and one pursuit, and everyone who he met, you know, he would badger with this one goal and one pursuit, which was to make genocide a crime. And so he was really badgering Ben at that time to incorporate it into the Nuremberg trials, because at that time, what they were able to try was crimes against humanity and war crimes. So genocide was not in the books. They couldn't do that. And so Ben at that time couldn't rewrite everything, even though he saw the legitimacy of Lemkin's goal. So what he did do is he used the word, and it was probably the first time the word had ever been used in a court in that setting, but he could not make genocide a crime. And it would only be until years later that genocide actually became a crime, and it is today, as we know, a crime, and it could be prosecuted in the International Criminal Court. But Ben's first impression, I think, were a very, you know, dogged individual, but also one who compromised his well-being for the pursuit of his goal. Mm-hmm. And I think that made an impression on Ben. He felt his pain. He understood that this was a very pained individual. And I think that he felt, you know, compassion for him and respected him for what he was trying to do.
Yeah, describes him with worn suits and crumpled shirts.
Yeah.
We're talking about that character of Raphael Lemkin. He's the man who came up with the word genocide, which later gave the international community a legal framework for preventing and prosecuting this crime against humanity. The filmmaker Edith Belzberg is with us. Her documentary about Lemkin and four other people working tirelessly to hold today's perpetrators of genocide accountable is called Watchers of the Sky. So by pigeonholing senators and statesmen at the time, Lemkin was able to get enough votes to help ratify the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. This is in, I think, 48.
Yes.
So how has it been invoked since then? You must prove that it is deliberate.
Yes, I mean, it's been invoked a few times. I mean, we've seen it with the case of, which is currently going on, of Ratko Mladic, who's responsible for the Serbian massacre, and thankfully, Luis Moreno Ocampo, who is a character in the film, he used it when he indicted Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, for the crimes committed in Darfur. And so it's been invoked, thankfully, a few times. Unfortunately, we haven't seen Bashir arrested yet, even though he has been convicted of committing genocide and crimes against
humanity. That's the thing. He can be indicted, but there is no real international, you know, police force that will go and arrest him. That's, I think part of this is about the will of the global superpowers, you know?
Yes, no, absolutely. And that's the problem that we currently face, is how, once these leaders are indicted, how do we arrest them? How do we bring them to face justice and to trial, and so that they no longer lead with impunity? And I think that's something that's important to remember about Lemkin, is he lobbied with the UN in 1948. It's almost unheard of. I mean, this is one individual. He didn't speak, English was not his native language. He didn't represent an organization or an institution or a country. He barely had an address to call his own. He was struggling financially, had very little money, and yet he spent every day going to the UN, every day he went to the UN to lobby ambassadors and delegates to push forward this crime. And we, you know, and it makes one wonder, my God, this is one individual who is able to bring all the countries of the UN together to pass a resolution in 1948. And it's remarkable. And I think one of the reasons why Lemkin is, you know, a hero, an unknown hero of our time, is that he did this. He really gave his life for this cause, and I hope that we as a people can pick up this torch, this incredibly bright torch that this one man left.
That's my earlier conversation with Edith Belzberg, Academy Award-nominated documentary film director and producer. Her film Watchers of the Sky debuted at Sundance last year and is now available on demand. Thank you so much for listening and for remembering today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.